This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Liev Schreiber stars in the new version of The Manchurian Candidate as war hero Raymond Shaw, the role played in the 1962 version by Lawrence Harvey. Here's a scene from the original movie, in which Ben Marco, played by Frank Sinatra, complains to his former commanding officer about a series of bad dreams. Douglas Henderson plays the CO.
Mickey, listen to me, please. For the last 6 months, I've been driven nearly out of my mind by the same recurring dream.
The medical officer in charge...
What the hell does a medical corps know about intelligence work, Milt? I tell you, there's something phony going on. There's something phony about me, about Raymond Shaw, about the whole Medal of Honor business. For instance, when the psychiatrist asked me how I felt about Raymond Shaw, how I personally felt about him, and how the whole patrol felt about him, did you hear what I said? Did you really hear what I said? I said Raymond Shaw is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life. And even now I feel that way, this minute. And yet, somewhere in the back of my mind, something tells me it's not true. It's just not true. It isn't as if Raymond's hard to like. He's impossible to like. In fact, he's probably one of the most repulsive human beings I've ever known in my whole, all of my life.
And what I came to tell you is... Public relations has bounced you back to me. And in your present state, there's no possible way I can use you. As of this moment, I'm placing you on indefinite sick leave. Go away, Ben. Find yourself a girl. Lie in the sun.
I absolutely refuse.
Now, in this scene from the new movie, Marco is played by Denzel Washington. He's trying to describe his bad dreams and concerns to Raymond Shaw, played by Liev Schreiber.
There are these dreams that some of the men from our unit have been having.
Including you?
Well, it's more of a question of what actually happened the night that our patrol got attacked.
Am I in your dreams, Captain?
Yes, you are, Congressman.
Saving everybody.
It's a whole lot more complicated than that. Now, Corporal Melvin, he's been drawing these pictures and he wrote down what he dreams. Maybe if you just
take dreams, Captain.
At all? You mean you don't dream at all? Everybody dreams,
well,
right?
Captain, I'd like to help you. I would. I really would. But if you, I think you ought to see somebody. Somebody who specializes.
I've been to doctors.
Well, good. That's very good, because they can probably help you out a lot more than I can.
I don't know, but...
Take care, Captain.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by.
Okay.
Terry spoke to Liev Schreiber in 1999 from his home in Manhattan. She started with his 1996 film, The Day Trippers.
This is a really funny film, and your character in this is a would-be novelist.
Mm-hmm.
Your girlfriend is played by Parker Posey. And in this scene, you're in a car with her whole family, her sister, who's just found a letter indicating her husband is probably having an affair, and their parents. The mother is played by Ann Mira. And in this scene, Parker Posey is explaining to her parents that you're writing a novel.
It's far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah, sure, Carl.
Well... Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Animal, yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh, yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal, except for the man with the dog's head, who really only wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially important that it's a pointer, because that's a crucial metaphor, because in the book, he's sort of a visionary, you know? You know, pointing the way to salvation.
You're really funny in that scene, and I think this kind of pretentious would-be writer is probably a familiar character to you. You probably have met many of people you could have based this on.
Yeah. Greg Mottola is the guy who's my best friend, who actually wrote Day Trippers and directed it. Has a good dose of Carl in him, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. But much more refined.
Uh-huh. Tell me more about this character for you.
When they initially gave me this script, I guess I kind of did have a reputation for playing kind of awkward characters or sort of weird characters, and I guess in to some extent, it's probably because I identify with them, and I think ultimately audiences probably do as well. I don't believe that we identify with the romantic lead. I think that we want to love them or take care of them, but I think that all of us, out of our insecurity, tend to identify with the other guy. And Carl, to me, was a terrific example of that, because here was a guy who was a completely obnoxious pain in the butt all the time. So what was redeeming about him? What was interesting about him? Because you're going to, obviously, if you're going to play this part, you're going to get a lot of good gags. You're going to get a lot of good gags in which you can make a lot of jokes at the character's expense. But is there something about him that we can identify with? And what I really loved about Carl was that everything that Carl was doing that was obnoxious was in the service of being liked.
Just, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And that's all he really wanted. He really just wanted to be liked. Uh-huh. He wanted people to like him, which is something that I think we can all identify with. I mean, the ludicrous things that we do on a daily basis just because we want to impress somebody or we want somebody to love us. I thought it was a tremendously sweet gesture from that character. Everything that he did that was so obnoxious to me seemed wonderfully sweet.
Let's go to another scene of yours. This is from Scream 2, in which you play Cotton, the character who's done time for murders that he didn't commit. And at the beginning of Scream 2, he's released from prison, and a TV reporter played by Courtney Cox kind of brings him to the character who he had been, you know, accused of terrorizing, Neve Campbell. And she wants to interview them both together, and Neve Campbell is just appalled that something so insensitive could be happening here. So she leaves. Later, he catches up with her in the library and insists that they do an interview together because he's gotten this great offer from Diane Sawyer.
Who calls me out of the blue? But Diane Sawyer. Believe me, Sid, I was as shocked as you are. Anyway, she tells me that if you and I go on the air together, she will give us the entire hour.
What?
We're talking prime time, Sid. You, me, and Diane Sawyer.
I can't.
Look, this is about money. It's not like we're not getting paid, okay? There's $10,000 each, not to mention what I've got going on the side with a 900 number.
Cotton.
I know. You don't like the press. I know that, and I respect it, Sydney. But Sydney, it's Diane Sawyer. Hello. She's a class act, Sydney. This could be some very, very heavy exposure. I'm sorry.
Look. Between the movie and the book, people know the truth. Let's get on with our lives. There's been enough exposure. Why would you want any more?
Why? No, I don't know, Sydney. I don't know. Maybe because I f***ing deserve a little exposure. I mean, come on, Sydney. You drag my name through the mud. Everybody thinks I'm some kind of psycho killer. And all I'm asking for is one little f***ing Diane Sawyer interview to maybe get my side of the story straight. Now, I don't think I'm being unreasonable in that request, Sydney. Do you honestly...
That's Liev Schreiber and Neve Campbell from Scream 2. This is a really funny role, and you're playing a character who we don't know how psycho he really is in the audience.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
We don't know how crazy he is or just how frustrated he is from being wronged.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like very compelling, but you're speaking in a pretty quiet voice in this scene as opposed to the kind of shouting and ranting you might expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, what I think is was so phenomenal about the whole Scream series is that Wes and Kevin Williamson...
The director and
Wes
writer.
Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson, the director and writer. What we were trying to do in those films that I think really worked well and was a great idea was to sort of take people's expectations of the genre, of the horror suspense genre, and kind of turn them around, give the audience a little credit for their intelligence. I mean, it's the most predictable medium. Really, it has become that, I think, you know, watch out behind you kind of thing. And was to sort of take these cliches and try and, make them a little more interesting. And, you know, the idea of the guy who's been stewing in jail, who served time for a crime he didn't commit and now wants vengeance, is that, you know, it already sets you up, so you kind of want to play against it, I think, or find an angle that's more interesting. And to me, what was interesting about it at the time we were making it, and still is this kind of, you know, media circus that goes on in the world today, is that everybody has their 15 minutes of fame, and they're trying really hard to make sure it's a good 15 minutes. And what to me was funny as a motivation for Cotton was that, you know, here everybody was getting famous off these murders and he was doing time. So he figured it was time for him to get his 15 minutes. And
Did you like horror films as a kid?
I hated them.
Why?
I still hate them because they scare the piss out of me. And I hate being scared. Yeah. It was interesting when I did the first one, I really just walked down some stairs, and I did it as a favor for a friend who worked for Miramax and Dimension at the time. He said, "Well, you know, will you just do this?" And I said, "Yeah, well, are you sure?" It was the easiest money I ever made. I walked down some stairs for 20 minutes. And afterwards, the writer came up to me, Kevin, and he said, "You know, I'm really glad you're doing this because we're planning a sequel." And I said, "No, wait a minute. I don't want to do that." And they said, "Well, why? Why? It's really wonderful." I said, "Yeah, the script's wonderful and everything. I love it. But I don't want to be in horror movies. I don't like them. I don't like the violence. I don't want to kill anybody, and I don't like getting killed." And at that time, I'd been in a lot of movies where I was getting killed, and it was upsetting my mother and me that I was dying so often in films. So I had made a promise that I wouldn't die anymore. And in the second one, we put together this contract that it was very, very patient of them to put together, where I would say, "Well, I don't die, and I don't want to kill anybody." And sort of this impossible task of, well, then how do you act in a horror movie if you don't die and you don't want to kill people?
Liev Schreiber, speaking with Terry Gross. He's co-starring in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate, which opens today. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with actor Liev Schreiber. He's co-starring in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate. When they spoke in 1999, Terry asked him about the film A Walk on the Moon. The story takes place in 1969, the summer of Woodstock and the first moonwalk. Schreiber plays a husband and father whose family vacations in a bungalow colony in the Catskills. In this scene, he finds out his wife is having an affair. She even went to Woodstock with the guy while her husband was working in the city.
Where'd you meet him?
He's a salesman.
Phew! This is great. It's like a Johnny Yoon routine. So is he a traveling salesman?
Sorta.
What's he sell? Blouses. He's the blouse man. He's screwing the blouse man. Jesus, Pearl. Why don't you screw the dress man? At least that way you get a whole outfit, you know?
After a role like Walk on the Moon, I would think that you really understand what it's like to grow up in a pretty conventional middle class family. And then I was reading about you, and you didn't grow up in a conventional middle class family at all.
No.
Tell us something about your mother and the home that you grew up in.
Well, my mother and I moved to New York when I was about 5 years old, and my mother was a bit of an eccentric. She was an artist, and moving to New York for her, poverty was no problem. In fact, poverty was kind of an adventure for her. So we lived in, buildings without electricity and hot water. And my mother had jobs. She was a cab driver. She made paper mache puppets. She had a health food business. She did everything that she could, or everything that she wanted to make a living, and was kind of successful at it. What was so wonderful about Walk on the Moon was that. When Dustin and I met on Sphere, my grandfather, who had kind of been the father figure in my life, had passed away fairly recently. And I was very upset by that and still very kind of confused with it and processing it. And suddenly Dustin came to me with this script. And it was one of those sort of serendipitous moments where you are allowed to work something out through your job. And the character of Marty was essentially, in my mind, he just reminded me so much of my grandfather. And that kind of work ethic and that kind of life and that kind of relationship was something that I was familiar with through him. And
what kind of work did your grandfather do?
He delivered meat to diners. And he had a little van that I used to go out with him in the mornings, and he would deliver meat to like Jones Diner on Great Jones Street and Dubrow's up in the Fashion District, And, it was really hard work. But at the same time, my grandfather had this, this blue-collar job. He was also, he also played the cello and collected art. So that kind of contradiction in character, which I thought was Marty as well, was he was a guy who really was very interested in science and wanted very much to pursue academia, but didn't have the opportunity because he was supporting his family and was incredibly loyal to his family and a real, I think, mensch is the perfect word for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much my grandfather.
How did you decide you wanted to act?
I think I was just one of those kids who early on in English class was always sort of volunteering to read the Shakespeare. I had, for one reason or another, taken to Shakespeare right away, and had always been good with language and was an early reader. And I think maybe in feeling a little bit like an outsider growing up, being different and what have you, I think that I sort of leapt at the opportunity to assimilate. And for me, oddly enough, acting was assimilating. It was showing that you could act like everyone else. You could be normal. People could identify with you. You could make jokes. You could make people laugh. You could affect people's feelings where socially you felt maybe you weren't. It wasn't as easy to do that. Through acting, it was not only easy, but it was safe. And it was also a tremendous amount of fun. And I thought, geez, if I can get paid to do that, that'd be cake.
I think for most actors, like their faces and their bodies determine in part the roles that they're given, mm-hmm. the roles that they're allowed to play. How do you think the way you look has affected the roles that you've gotten?
I'm not sure. It's changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably what has served me best, ironically, is a certain amount of anonymity that I've enjoyed for the past 7 years, that people don't know who I am, and that's been great for me because it's allowed me to do a lot of different kind of characters. I think that one of the problems with Hollywood that I've never had to come up against and probably will now, I'll probably be playing Orson Welles type characters for the next year or so, is that you are as good as your last role. And because I've been able to do kind of supporting roles in smaller character parts and have not really done any press to speak of until this past year, it's really allowed me to do a lot of different kinds of things, which has just been wonderful.
Yeah, you've said in one interview that there's two different kinds of full-time jobs. One is celebrity and the other is actor.
Yeah.
Have you met a lot of celebrity actors who, for whom you think celebrity has really interfered with their ability to act?
I think it can interfere with your ability to act because what happens is you have to... celebrity really is a full-time job if you choose to pursue it. And then part of pursuing it is embracing the character that the press has assigned you. And that in itself is acting. And if you spend all of your time doing that character, your range is decreased, and the acceptance of the public to see you as anything else is also very limited. And I think that, it's like the thing I was saying before about playing character in general, is that audiences want to go to a theater, I believe, and become the characters in the film. They want to identify with the characters in the film. And I think the more you define yourself outside of being an actor, as being a personality or as a celebrity, the more difficult it is for them to identify with the character you're playing in the film or in the play. And there's the sad part of that is that it kind of then they lose their ability to identify with you as the character. And whereas we may want to watch the celebrity and we may fantasize about having some sort of relationship with that celebrity, ultimately, we're not as connected to the story because we're just watching the celebrity and not participating in the story ourselves.
Well, Liev Schreiber, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Liev Schreiber, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. He's starring in the new remake of The Manchurian Candidate.